In this episode of Zen Founder, Sherry interviews Patrick Campbell, the co-founder and CEO of Price Intelligently. Patrick is one of the foremost experts on SaaS pricing, software as a service pricing, but you don't need to know much about that to get a lot out of this interview. Patrick's youth was filled with, you know, many challenges, and it built a resilience in him that you can see in the businesses that he starts today. It's a very interesting and really well done founder origin story today. So I hope you enjoy it. Before we get to that, I would encourage you to head to zenfounder.com and get on our email list. In fact, Sherry released a really cool email mini course on work-life balance, why we're failing and how to do better, how to be amazing at growing your business without neglecting your life. So you can get that whole course as well as some of the recent articles she's published on the Zen Founder blog that she then, you know, will send out to the email list, include articles on raising gifted kids, beating isolation, how to make friends as an adult, perfectionism, the good, the bad, and the ugly, how to talk to kids about entrepreneurship, hacking the system, what you need to do about the vagus nerve, and others. So it's really interesting stuff, and it's two or three articles a month that she's writing and can share with you via email. And it's really interesting and unique thought. You know, if you've listened to this podcast for a while, you know that Sherry has a unique perspective that isn't just something that you could read on any website. So it's her perspective on these topics. So head over to zenfounder.com. There's a little drip widget and you can enter your email there to be updated on everything that we're up to and hear about Sherry's thoughts week to week. So let's dive in.
We plan to talk through the issues faced by startup founders and the people close to them.
That overused phrase, work-life balance.
It is an amazingly focusing time.
This is what we do, you know, aside from our families, this is our whole work life.
I am also known as Dr. Wine.
You know, this is a little bit non-traditional.
A little more zen in the startup life.
Zen founder.
Those days were a mental struggle.
I have been stressed in the past, and I know that I will be in the future.
A founder and his or her significant other will both get value from the episode.
I will say, so I do a lot of podcasts, and this podcast, I've been the most anxious, and it's been a weird feeling. It's been, I knew this was coming because we scheduled it. And normally I don't even really think about, because it's like, oh, we're going to talk about pricing and we're going to talk about X, Y, and Z with business. And this one, I'm like, oh, I got to talk about feelings. So it's been, I'm ready. I think I'm ready, but I definitely am.
As long as you're good and anxious, then it'll be fantastic. Yeah.
Well, as long as I say something, right? Like, might just be a lot of like feelings and no real objectives or conclusions, but we'll see.
Okay, so I'm really okay without objectives or conclusions. Is that weird? Am I weird?
No, it's cool. You're documenting, which I think is really cool. Like, I've listened to other episodes, and some of them, you know, it's like, it's all like all content. Like, some of them you're like, oh my God, that made me want to cry. That was wild for good and bad reasons. Or it was kind of like, eh, not for me, but that was interesting, you know, and that's what's great about documenting stories like this, or, you know, content like this.
Yeah. I feel like it's hard to make really specific, accurate recommendations about people's lives without really knowing the ins and outs of their situation, which is why I feel like advicey podcasts or advicey columns, you know, you have to be a little bit generic.
Yeah. Well, that's what makes it, it's kind of, I don't know, I don't, it makes it kind of not great, right? Because I would rather write or do like more specific things. And I think you're kind of doing something specific, which is great, because then you're going to have a better or a more in-depth hit rate, right? You know, so if I listen to a podcast where I can like really empathize, it's like, holy cow, like that really affected me, which I think is great.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of people who listen to this podcast will have heard of you and be familiar with your work, but then there's this section of folks that listen that aren't necessarily tech entrepreneurs. Like, I have a strong following among dentists. Thank you, dentists.
Did I brush my teeth this morning? Oh no.
I hope so. Did you floss? Oh, they're always after you about flossing.
Oh my God. We're not even going to go there.
This might be the hardest part of the conversation, but like, what is your day job, Patrick? How do you, what is your job? What do you do?
So I'm the CEO of a company called Profitwell. We create free subscription financial metrics, then have a bunch of products that basically help subscription businesses, but a little bit more of a specific step down is we're about 50 people and growing pretty quickly. So my job from a tactical standpoint is, you know, kind of building the teams that still haven't been built and then, you know, helping maintain and you know, grow the other teams as well. And so there's a lot, it's kind of, it's not always putting out fires, which is good, but it's a lot of just a lot of stressful and not so stressful planning and strategic work. And then doing all the mechanical work and some things as well. So it's a hodgepodge, I guess is the best summary.
Yeah. So you lead people, you lead a team of about 50 people, which is that's a sizable group of folks.
Yeah. And it's funny how it kind of grows from, you know, you kind of know everybody and I still know everybody. It's just more the depth to which you know them starts to change. And that means the expectations and the hygiene around what you say, how you say it becomes a little bit more important, but you still want to be yourself and real. And all of that can kind of mix to make a pretty tough situation.
Yeah, it's sort of, you're coming up against lots of people's filters of you, right? People have an impression of who you are and what you do and why you do it. And when you get to 50 or more people, there's just a lot of different perspectives to try to be somewhat mindful of, but yet still have that burden of trying to be yourself and authentic. And
well, it makes it tough because you almost are forced to become a little bit fake or have a little facade because, you know, for example, like I used to back in, you know, my corporate days, you know, wear almost a tie every day and that kind of thing. And now I'm athleisure sweatpants and a t-shirt every day. And all of a sudden now, because I don't have all these interactions with folks, it's like, oh, like maybe I should start wearing a button up every day. And maybe I should be more business casual, right? And, you know, I don't know if that's me or that's not me, but there's a lot of those little things where you're like, it kind of feels like, I don't know, the consistency's not there. And then all of a sudden, if I show up to work in a suit every day, that also doesn't feel right. And so, I don't know, it's the nature of trying to lead with a lot of ambiguity and, you know, trying to do the right thing.
Yeah, finding your voice as a leader. So you're an economist by training.
Yeah, so it's funny because that's kind of like a catch-all, right? It's kind of like a developer. You know, there's lots of different types of developers. But for me, you know, I always wanted to be, like numbers always felt, you know, as they are, very concrete. And, you know, I studied economics and econometrics and math in college and ended up jumping out. And I worked in the intelligence community in DC and I worked at Google, basically doing econ modeling, which is trying to take a bunch of data and build something that explains it, build something that makes order out of it so that you can predict or you can find some sort of outcome. And that's always really been, you know, fascinating to me. And if you look at a lot of our products, you know, I'm not leading product any longer, but a lot of our products like really guide in that direction too, which is great.
It's so interesting because we think about numbers and data as concrete, but yet they're meaningless without an interpretive mechanism, which is not always super concrete.
Yeah, it's terrible sometimes because there is no, I mean, that's the nature of statistics. There's never 100%, you know, and even if you find something that's close, it's a confidence interval that's X, Y, or Z. And so, yeah, it's interesting. It's this weird precipice of trying to make something concrete, but realizing it never will be, but you still have to pursue that concreteness.
You have to make decisions based on as if it were concrete.
Absolutely. Or close enough, a lot of hedging, that kind of stuff. And we're bootstrapped. So it means we haven't raised funding. And so we've had to be even closer to that because a lot of times, and this sometimes makes us, I don't know, I fear that sometimes we're a little too cautious with some things because, you know, we're like, well, that seemed like, how do we test that in a smaller fashion, right? Well, some tests, they just can't be tested in a very tiny way. They have to be tested big. And so that kind of runs up against that concreteness or that hedging, if you will.
Yeah. So I used to teach statistics at the college level. And I gave extra credit to this woman who wrote a rap on the law of large numbers to the tune of Baby Got Back.
I love it.
It was amazing. I got to find that woman and have her do it here on the show. Anyway, how did you kind of get to this place? I mean, I know that's a really big question and a long story, but were you raised in a family that had entrepreneurs or economists, or what were the early signs that this would be your outcome?
Yeah, I think the short answer is no. I'm from a really small town in Wisconsin that has more cows than people, as the fun saying goes. And I think that for me, it's tough, right? Because you want to be introspective. You want to know thyself and understand why you don't like the things you do and why you do like the things you do. And I think for me, my background is my parents are both very blue collar. I was the first person, you know, to go to college in the family. My dad's a tinner, which is like a sheet metal worker, which basically means that he, you know, helped put metal roofs on like sky rise or high rises and things like that. My mom, she works from kind of being on an assembly line to becoming a trade show marketer. And that was kind of like a 35-year trajectory. And so she went from being on like the line building electric motors, actually, Lisan Electric in Grafton, Wisconsin, to basically being an executive assistant. And then, you know, going from there to starting to do kind of the trade show and event marketing. But I think for me, you know, the thing that I get most from kind of my upbringing was this whole sense of working really hard was important. But one like really positive thing that I got from my parents was my dad in particular, he didn't have a lot of friends. His friends were always with the people that he worked with. And he's kind of like a straight-laced guy. He's also in the Navy. He didn't drink. Like, I've never seen my father take a drink, which makes some other things kind of ironic. But he was always really obsessed with learning. So one of these kind of guys who he went to a couple classes in college and then just got involved with the trade union. But the biggest thing I think that had such an effect on me when I'm trying to understand is that he basically just would go buy used textbooks. He would go buy books. And he would come home from work, he'd just read the books, you know, understand the books. And they were all kind of related to his trade. This is a kind of guy who basically he's now become an HVAC engineer. And, you know, he's actually coding the Honeywell controllers at Northwestern Mutual in Milwaukee better than the actual Honeywell guys because he read all the books and read all of the like history of it and stuff like that and taught himself how to do it. And so I think that was like the big thing because all of a sudden, like, I was like, oh, I can learn and I can figure out problems on my own. And I think that's what really drove me amongst, you know, other things. So I don't know if that was too hard of a tangent on your question, but that's kind of a pretty big thing.
No, I think that's such a common story among entrepreneurs that I've talked to. There's someone in their lives or they have some experience where they come to believe in their own capacity for learning and to be self-taught and self-motivated.
I really like that. Yeah.
That's so essential to what it means to be an entrepreneur because all of us who are trying to run our own business, like I don't know anything about marketing. I don't know anything about WordPress, like, but you have to just sort of learn these things as you go. And if you don't believe that you can teach yourself, then you're really not going to last too long or you're going to spend all of whatever money you have trying to hire out every little thing instead of learning how to do some things yourself.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, for me, it was also, and you and I have talked about this in the past, like it was also driven by like a deep insecurity, I think, for me as well. So like the one differentiator I really had as like a kid and things like that is that I was pretty smart. You know, school was pretty easy. I really took things up really well. And, you know, that was like the one like affirmation that was consistently that I got. And I think for me, like from an entrepreneur perspective, there's a certain part of me that is an entrepreneur because I'm incredibly insecure, which I know is a little bit ironic, but it's because like that concreteness that we were talking about, I get concreteness out of, cool, I have some connection to this thing that's getting done and we're figuring it out and we're figuring out that problem together. I'm not in a, you know, corporate environment where figuring out that problem might take 9 months. You know, I need an answer, right? I need that concreteness or that security of an answer. And so I think that's what really helped as kind of like a tangent off of the learning, which was, you know, I was able to, you know, get security from like knowledge and finding things out and affirmation from being the person who knew things or who could figure things out as well.
When did you come to understand yourself as smart?
This was kind of a hard thing. I think because even you saying that and even me saying that the sentence before, I have like a visceral reaction to saying
a
that.
Reaction against
yeah,
it.
I have this like visceral reaction of, you know, I graduated first in my class in college. I was kind of a terror in high school. And so I didn't really do as much homework. So I did okay, but I got like, you know, close to a 4.0 without even like doing much, right? And so I think for me, I knew I had something when I was really young and my father was, I mean, force is a strong word, but I think it's the right word, was basically like forcing me to learn like things at a higher level. So I was learning like, you know, kind of put like calculus textbooks in front of me at the age of 10 and things like that. And was like, hey, you should learn this. And I think what ended up happening is that when I got into some of these classes and I was like, oh, I've seen this before. Like I've already know what's going on. That's when I didn't necessarily feel smart. It was just more like, oh, like I already know this. Cool. Like, let me learn the next thing. Like, let me learn the next thing. And then I think later it was one of those things where when I actually had my first job and, you know, there's always that kind of like first 90 days of trepidation where people are kind of like in that first 90 day funk. But I was already like starting to crush some of the goals that I was trying to go after because I was like using that knowledge. And when I was further ahead than, you know, some of my peers, I was like, oh, okay. Like, you know, maybe I'm not smart, but I at least can think through these problems really quickly. And I don't have that like trepidation or that kind of film of needing to politic through something.
I mean, in a way, you've reframed that in a really sort of psychologically healthy way, you know that.
No, I know. Literally after I just answered that, I was like, man, I don't think I answered her question. I think I just rationalized some things like in my life that I shouldn't have. It was like, oh, Jesus, I'm getting a free session. I love it.
Oh, whatever. I do think though that, I mean, yeah, there is this aversion to being like, oh yeah, I'm smart or I'm a smart kid. And maybe it gets it's a little easier in high school when you get sort of identified as the honors track or the college bound or whatever. But I do think that we have different abilities, and intellectual capacity is one of the myriad of abilities that you can be endowed with. Because it strikes me that you're talking about your sense of insecurity or inferiority, and or insecurity is the word that you used. But yet, it sounds like from early on in life, you were also aware of, or at least had an expectation by your father that you would be someone who could do calculus at 10.
Yeah, I think it was more, so it's funny you say it that way, because I think you're, it's an interesting like perspective or an interesting like assessment, because the reason like I have this, you know, somewhat inferiority complex, or I don't think I'm using that and from like the textbook definition or this insecurity, is that, I mean, it was a pretty like tough like environment and a tough childhood. I think that it wasn't necessarily bad. Like I had it better than a lot of other kids, especially growing up in like a rural town in America. But I think for me, you have to understand that like the environment that I grew up in, intelligence was great, but intelligence was also kind of like a, like, oh, you're the smart kid or you're like that kid, right? And
it's almost a liability.
Yeah, a little bit. But I think it's more like there's this weird like situation where like my brother, like I love my brother. My brother is, he's an electrician. He does really, really well. He's got his wife, kid, all that kind of fun stuff. But my brother's kind of like the stereotypical, like whether you become a doctor or whether you become like a laborer in Wisconsin, like especially like around where I grew up, like, and it's kind of natural in a lot of parts in the Midwest, but you end up a couple minutes down the road from where you grew up, you live for your job, your family, church in a lot of cases, and then the Green Bay Packers. And that's kind of life. And when I started having like these pursuits, like I was literally just talking to a partner in the business about, you know, just personally about like, so when I was growing up, like I was really into like theater and I was really into like, you know, some of these other things, like, and, you know, I was, you know, called gay, or I was like, you know, questioned like by my own family, like, oh, are you like just as like, that's a bad thing. Right. Or I wasn't, you know, ever good enough, like from sports, like I excelled pretty well in sports, but I excelled even further in speech and debate. And that wasn't like the mold, if you will. And so
that wasn't like a cool activity to be good at.
Yeah. It was like, yeah, you're a national finalist in high school in debate. And that doesn't get me any street cred. Like I make the varsity team, or I suit up for a varsity game as a freshman, and like it's like I like am the golden son, you know. And it was just one of those things where I think that like my parents did the best they could, and they did really well, like compared to, you know, other folks and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, I turned out okay. My brother turned out okay. Like we're both, you know, good folks. But from an insecurity standpoint, it was like the only thing that I really got affirmation for was like the intelligence. And then other folks would like make that as a liability. And so it just kind of mixed into this like, great, I need to solve things and I need to be smart in order to like succeed, but I also need to be like very self-deprecating, like not facetiously self-deprecating, like actually self-deprecating to like almost survive. And so don't know if that makes sense, but it was just like...
It's such a mixed bag. It's such a mixed message, right? We're glad you're good at this, but don't be too good at it because that will... We don't want you to be arrogant and we don't want you to be whatever, but we really want you to be go to football. Like, it's just a set of mixed expectations about like, who am I supposed to be?
You know what's kind of crazy? So my father to this day wants me to be a doctor. Because if you think about like the natural progression of like working class families, it's like someone's a laborer to become a skilled laborer to become like a professional, right? Like a lawyer or like something. And like that's the generations. And it's almost like to this day, it's like, oh, you could be a good doctor. You should be a doctor, right? And I'm like, Dad, I've created like a multi-million dollar company that's growing. Like, isn't that good enough, right? And it's kind of like, no, it's not, you know, because I'm not a doctor, because that's the concept of what that intelligence should be used for. Yeah, so it is an interesting mixed bag.
One of the things that we bonded over the first time that we met is I just remember talking with you about our somewhat recent story of becoming guardians of a little girl who needed a place to live. And we've talked about that on the podcast before. People can go back and listen to that episode if they care. But you've had some similar experiences of not always living with your parents. Is that something you want to talk about or feels okay to talk about?
Yeah, I think it's okay to talk about a bit. I think, yeah, so I mean, I kind of alluded to this before, but there were definitely some really, really tough years and months. And I kind of had, like, if I didn't have, you know, they weren't official guardians, but if I didn't have some teachers and I didn't have some, like, actual mentors, I think I wouldn't have ended up in a good, like, centered place as I've kind of, you know, grown up. I think I would have ended up, and this is hard to say, but I think I would have ended up like just kind of, you know, wasting my days away rather than, you know, trying to do something. And yeah, but it's been a big thing. So
what did those teachers or other grownups kind of add to your life that you so needed at that point?
I think it was just encouragement. Yeah, I think it was kind of weird too, because growing up in like a public school environment, and we were in like a good area. Like, I had some teachers who told me I wouldn't amount to anything. Like, I can't even just imagine like telling a child that, let alone like a high school student. But I remember I told my English teacher and I said, hey, like we were talking about like what do you want to do in college and all that kind of stuff. And I was like, oh, I want to be a Rhodes Scholar, you know, because I would like Bill Clinton was, you know, someone that I looked up to at the time. Let's not get into that. I mean, we can if you want, but it was one of those things that this was before the Lewinsky and all that kind of fun stuff. But it was one of those things where I was like, oh, like this is, you know, he was a Rhodes Scholar. Like, I think I can do that as well. And, you know, just kind of told me that like, you know, like that's not for someone like you. But I had other teachers, you know, particularly my speech and debate coach in high school, and then a really good English teacher in middle school who like noticed, at least in, you know, kind of post hoc rationalization, noticed like, hey, this kid's got some skills, or at the very least, you know, he's not a terrible kid and, you know, needs a little bit of encouragement. And I think those teachers, they really kind of convinced me that, you know, this is something where you can like get out, you know, you can get out of this cycle of, you know, your insecurity, and you can get out of the cycle of not having the confidence, you know, to keep going. And I guess what I'm trying to say is it filled kind of like an emotional support gap that I just didn't really feel I had, or maybe I didn't, you know, really seek out. Like, for example, like the only reason I went to the college that I went to, even though I got into like other more prestigious schools, was because my speech and debate coach in high school was like, if you want to do speech and debate in college, this is the college you have to go to. I did a site visit, but like it didn't even matter if I did the site visit. So I was like, oh, cool, I'm going to Peoria, Illinois of all places for school. Yeah. So I think it's the emotional gap. And it's kind of funny because like I can even tell, like, as I'm talking about this, that that anxiety that I was talking, you know, about before we started recording, I'm like kind of rambling. My voice isn't as like, you know, firm and things like
it's
that.
It's thinner than it normally is.
Oh, I know. Yeah. I'm like, oh my God, this, I'm still carrying this, you know, even though I've, you know, dealt with it for a decade and a half or so.
What do you mean you're still carrying it? Like, what do you mean?
I think it's, so here's the funny thing. So like, I'm still carrying this, I'm never going to be good enough mentality. And when I got to college, it was like, cool, if I graduate first in my class, I'll be good enough. And I did that and it didn't fill anything. If I become a Rhodes Scholar, I'm going to fill that. I didn't become that. I got to like the finals and all that kind of stuff, but it's still like not good enough. If I win a national title in debate, I'm going to fill that gap. I won a national title, and literally as they're handing me the trophy, like I thought I was going to have all this joy and this like emotion, and I was like almost dead inside. And you know, it was like, cool, if I go work for the government, I'm going to be good enough because I'm going to save, you know, lives. Didn't really feel it. Oh, I'm going to go work at Google because that's a really big brand, you know, didn't do anything. Oh, I'm going to start a company and I'm going to get to the first million. Didn't do anything. Oh, I'm going to get to 10 million. Still hasn't done anything. And so I think there's this weird, I've learned to cope with it. I don't know if I've solved it. I don't know if it's solvable. This like deep seated insecurity around like I'm never going to be good enough. And I found that it drives me, like it makes me really successful because like from an objective standpoint, because, oh, cool. Like someone's talking crap about me on Twitter. Great. I'm going to do this next blog post. I'm going to like get this project done. I'm going to do this. Like I'm going to prove everyone wrong, if you will. But sometimes it has like a really negative effect where like I get into a place where it's just like, it's not that I can't function, but if I don't have something where I'm achieving or I'm trying to achieve or I'm trying to learn or I'm trying to do something, I don't fall apart, but I come close. So like when I go on a week-long vacation, I've actually learned that I have to almost transition into a vacation because I'm not going to have that achievement. I'm not going to have that like grind. I'm going to have more of, oh, I don't know what to do. Like I'm not moving, if you will. So yeah, I think I'm still carrying that and I'm more coping with it and I've learned to cope with it versus like actually have solved it. And I don't know if I'm ever going to be able to solve it.
What do you imagine it would feel like to not feel that way? Sorry, that's such a lame ass psychology question, but like, you clearly like have the sense of like that feeling of not enough or feeling empty or feeling incomplete. And I guess I wonder if you have a picture of what it would feel like to feel differently.
Yeah. I don't know. I used to think it was money, and I know that's weird, but it all revolves around security, right? Like if I feel secure, that'll help me like with some of these demons, because then I have the freedom to do whatever and not have to worry about it. Right. And that's the logic. I'm not sure that's purely logical, but that's at least the logic that I'm working with. And I think, I was in not the greatest relationship for about 7 years, in my early 20s to my mid 20s. And it was, you know, realizing what I needed in a relationship. And so now I'm in a relationship where it's like, I feel so secure. Like I just feel, you know, I can be myself. I can talk about these things. I can talk about good things. And it's just like almost the perfect partner. I think that in addition to that, I'm really trying to rack my brain. Like I think, you know, some sort of like stability, and now I have good financial stability will help. But I guess what I'm trying to say is like, I don't really know. I think it's a time thing, because the way I was maybe 10 years ago, like when I was at Google, is very, very different than how I am now. And, you know, thankfully I had some good mentors. Actually, one of the managers I just didn't like and I thought was the worst manager ever was actually the best manager I've ever had. Not because everyone else was bad, but he just was really good and I didn't appreciate it. But I've also had other mentors along the way. And I think maybe it's just a time thing.
Like maturity, like growing into it.
Yeah, I think that's, I don't know, it's almost like one of those things where, you know, you chip away at it every month, very, very small amount, you chip away at it. And eventually it kind of grows, you know, and that's part of, you know, growing up just in general, and you're always growing or should always be growing. But, you know, when I look at like 10 years ago, how I like handled this or how I dealt with it versus today, I can only imagine that 10 years from now, I'm going to be so much better. And it's not like I'm debilitated now. It's just more that like, it's still on the mind. It's still something when I think about it, it's there. And, you know, hopefully within 10 years, it's like, yeah, it's still there. It's still on my mind, but it's, you know, even better than it is today.
It's so hard to rewrite the story that we heard about ourselves as children. I mean, I think we have such solid, whether you want to talk about research or theory, like what happens to us when we're kids matters a lot about who we believe ourselves to be. And when we don't have parents or caregivers who help us write like the best story for ourselves, whether they've got their own baggage or their own illness or their own pain that they're sort of projecting on us, like it just takes a long time to rewrite the story. And it's not easy to do. And it takes all of this data that we accumulate through better relationships and successes and things that we try and fail at and tolerate the failure and, you know, all of these other kinds of experiences. But it sort of takes like 20 years to undo the 10 years.
Yeah. Well, this is, I mean, frankly, one, this is why, this is why we started talking about this, at dinner that one time was, I really appreciate what you're doing, given the situation with your guardian. And I think in addition to that, it's also why I'm terrified to have kids. Because if I look at kind of the trajectory, my father was the way he is and is the way he is because of his father. They have a weird relationship and my grandfather's passed at this point, but like, I remember my dad telling me at one point when I was having like, a typical like emotional teenage, angst argument with him, like his father never told him he loved him. And like, I can't, before I was the age 20, and that's kind of after my father went to Iraq and, changed a bit. I maybe could count less than 10 times when my father had told me he loved me. And what I fear is, like, even though I have this context and thankfully I'm a bit introspective, I see a lot of like my father in me. It's good parts, as we talked about, and really bad parts, like how I handle certain things, right? Because that's what I saw when I was a kid. That's how I was wired. And sometimes I just like fear that when I have kids, that's what I'm going to do too. I'm gonna handle that incorrectly. And thankfully I've taken some of those bad parts and I've like learned to rewire them. But I just, cycles are so hard, when it comes to these types of things. And, I just want to, break that cycle, if you will.
Yeah. It is interesting the way we started our conversation, how you described that so much of your job is about essentially building teams and building people. It's almost like your work as an entrepreneur, your work at like helping new people come in to profit well and onboarding them and helping them know where they fit, helping them find their sweet spot, getting the most productivity, but also good ideas and creativity and joy from them. Like, this is not a perfect analogy, but in a way you're practicing what it is to help support a human.
That's cool. Yeah. Well, it's funny. I really hope that's the reason I'm like subconsciously, that's the reason I'm doing this, because that would explain maybe a lot. But it's actually interesting because I think I'm not always successful, but it's kind of funny because part of like this insecurity is being like taking things like deeply personal and also really, really caring. And so there's so much care that at least is felt when I'm trying, like when we have someone new or when a customer is having a bad experience, that it's really hard to kind of evoke like, hey, I really, really care about this. I do. I'm sorry. And when stuff happens internally, even it's like it's felt really deeply and like, oh, let's fix this. And I don't know. I kind of hope that is what's happening. And I hope maybe that's the reason that I've, been getting better at this.
I feel so hopeful for you. I mean, not that there's anything wrong with you at all, but like, just our conversation, I do think there's so much depth and emotional kind of capacity that you're becoming more and more comfortable with. And I think like all the ingredients are there to be a good parent if that's what you decide you want to do, but also to like continue in your own healing and your own sense of who you are in the world and who you want to be, like the story that you want to tell about yourself.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope it's just now it's a function of time. I'm okay with that, because I'm an impatient but patient person, depending on the day. So I'm okay with time. I think that's what's been really interesting is that like sometimes I feel like my life has been, multiple Lifetime movies. Like I'm like the terrible multi-actor on Lifetime. And so it's one of those things where I in hindsight though, my rationalization of that and plenty of stuff we didn't even get into, like, with cancer, which we were kind of talking about before. And it's one of those things where I feel like I've experienced enough that it's actually helping, like, cool, like all of that stuff happened and you're now here. That's awesome, right? And you weren't as good 5 years ago, you weren't as good 10 years ago, but you improved. And that means that, that hope of 5 years from now, 10 years from now, like must keep going up, right? Given all the other ingredients. And so I'm hopeful too, I guess, what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. So what was your experience with cancer?
Yeah. So I've had cancer twice now. I have a, just to add, you know, insult to injury, I have a, this is genetic, I don't know if it's a syndrome, which I don't really know what a difference between a syndrome and a disorder is. It's not anything that's like fatal, but it gives me a little bit of a higher propensity to get cancer. At least this is what we found. So I actually, when I was at Google, I had breast cancer, which is interesting, you know, given being a man, but men can get breast cancer. It's actually, it's not like a majority, but it's, you know, a good amount because we all have like glands. I found this out going through this. Some are active, some are inactive, but they can all get cancerous. And so that was kind of an interesting experience. I was at Google when it happened, which was like, if you're going to get sick at Google. I know we don't all have the, you know, ability or the luxury of being able to work there, but it was like, I had surgery, I had treatment and a bunch of other stuff. I didn't even see an invoice. Like it's not that I had an invoice I had to submit or something. Like I didn't even see an invoice. Like everything was taken care of. And that was tough because as you and I were kind of talking about it, it gives this weird sense of, you know, there's a quote out there where it's like you never thought you were Superman, but you kind of thought, well, at least I'll have, you know, my 20s, my 30s, et cetera. And it kind of forces you to face that. And it also is like a weird cultural and community dynamic because a lot of times, like the people around you, your loved ones, you know, it's not that they naturally or intentionally make it about them, but it's one of those things where it's, like my mom, for instance, took it really, really hard. And as you can imagine, right? You know, your kid gets sick and I had to almost, nope, I'm good, mom. Everything's fine. You know, even if I was having a bad day. And it wasn't a fun experience, but it was a hugely introspective experience again, where I felt as if I came out with an insane understanding of, you know, why it's so important to do what you want or do what you're trying to do with your life. And I think the only reason like I, you know, jumped in the startup world is because of that experience. Because when you work at Google, you're overpaid and, you know, you're on the golden treadmill as they talk about. But yeah. And then I ended up having it a second time. It wasn't breast cancer at this point. It was lymphoma. And I had it, I think it was 3 years into the company or two and a half. So we're about 6 years now. And that was tough because it was one of those things where because I had gone through that first experience, I was getting tested like a lot. And so it was one of those things where it was caught like super early. Like they wouldn't have found it if I wasn't like going in for natural kind of testing in remission. And so it was only radiation, which was great. For folks who don't know, that's basically like getting an x-ray for an hour a day for like
I
6 weeks.
Zap it.
Yeah, it's like not invasive and you get a little moody and a little tired and all that kind of fun stuff, but it's not like terrible. But yeah, that was another experience where like I knew because I had gone through the first experience, but like in both, it's kind of like a, you know, and given kind of the other stuff we were talking about, it's like, what else, right? Like I'm hoping my 30s are super boring. That's what I'm hoping for. Because my 20s and before were a little too exciting. But yeah, it was a tough experience.
I can imagine this, you know, especially the having the two experiences of one working at Google and then the second round being at what's now ProfitWell and the sense in which, I mean, such different pressures, such different implications for you taking time off or just being like emotionally distracted must have felt really different being an entrepreneur versus working for the behemoth company.
Yeah, I think so. When I was at Google, and this is why it was so great too, my boss, the one that I thought was terrible, was actually the best. He just went, you can just go home. He's like, you can just go home for an entire quarter. Like, we don't care. Like, he's like, you know, he did it in a very nice way, but he was just like, just go, like, we'll pay you. Like everything. And I was like, no. And I you know, did the natural thing where like I pushed myself, right? So I had a week off, or 2 weeks off for the surgery, but I was going to chemo like regularly. And like I just pushed myself so hard. I actually had one of my best quarters. Like I won this like award for performance and stuff like that. And so it's kind of interesting just in terms of like that kind of experience. But when I was as a founder or CEO, it was, I don't know, it was a little surreal because it was kind of the same swing motion where it was basically like, nope, stuff's got to get done. And same thing with like, not as much as my mom, but like other people in the company, it was kind of like, well, I got to take care of them. You know, I got to take care of them. And, you know, it was one of those things where I was totally upfront with the team and I was like, listen, like it was caught really early. This is happening. If you have any questions, like all that kind of stuff. And there were some people that were a little more, not like emotional, but like more emotional than others. And I just think it was one of those things where this is the first experience actually was why we have really good health insurance at ProfitWell was because, you know, we couldn't necessarily afford the, you don't see an invoice, but we can afford the, hey, this is, you see the invoice, but it's still not paid by you. Like that's the level that we have. And I think that helped a lot. I don't know. I think emotionally it's, if that would have been the first time, it would have been really bad because I would have had to take time off. I would have had to leave, but you know, it was almost like kind of stereotypical of what I've done, you know, since, you know, surviving early, which was, hey, like just get the job done. It's got to get done. Like someone's got to do it. And like taking control of that.
What is your next life lesson going to be, man? Like, so we've covered like hard work, taking care of other people emotionally, taking risks, doubling. I mean, yeah, I feel like you could have like a whole series of Lifetime movies about your life and maybe a couple of inspirational books. What's going to be next?
I hope it's like woodworking. Like, I hope it's like, hey, this is how you build a chair. Like that's, I hope it's that mechanical. And I don't know. I think it's just, you know, this is life, right? Like this is, I mean, yes, I've had, you know, some unique experiences, but they're not unique in probably the depth or the context, right? We all have like, you know, our emotional insecurities. We all have, you know, health stuff that comes up here and there. And some of us are really lucky and we haven't had any of those things, but we have anxiety about something, right? And I think I've won the Olympics on some of these things, but I think it's one of those things where it's, you know, it's not a contest, right? And I think that's the biggest thing that I've learned. And maybe that's like rationalization of trying to like make myself feel better of like, hey, like everyone suffers or everyone goes through this, but I think it's true. And I don't know, we'll see. I think it's part of the journey.
You just live in the moment that you're living in, right? I mean, you just sort of have to face what you have to face. It's not like you've gone out to pursue any of these experiences. It's what happens when you go through life and you live in a body and you live in a family, and sometimes the family works really well and sometimes the body works really well and sometimes it breaks down.
Yeah, no, 100%.
Well, I really appreciate you battling your nerves to talk with me about feelings.
Well, and you know, I don't get nervous like talking, but this is a little different. You know, if we're talking about pricing, I'd be slacking on my phone and still giving good answers, you know? So, yeah. No, this is good. It was I joked about it, but this is kind of a little bit of a therapy session, which is good.
Yeah. Well, I think you're a fabulous human and I'm glad you're doing what you're doing. So I appreciate you sharing your story with me and with the listeners, and I'm a fan.
Thank you. Appreciate that. And thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Zen Founder. Our theme song is A New Beginning by bensound.com, used under Creative Commons.